Let's move to the next occasion after the crucifixion, when Christianity attracted the notice of the custodians of Roman law and order. In A.D. 49, not very long after the death and resurrection of Christ, a wave of riots broke out in the very large Jewish community in Rome. Now, this is very important because in another context, I will relate it to its effect on the developing church in Rome, which is another part of this book that we're going back to by the Catholic scholars, Antioch and Rome, and their part in the developing viewpoint of the church. This wave of riots that broke out in the very large Jewish community in Rome occurred in AD 49. The trouble proved so intractable that the Emperor Claudius, by the way, when I preached a week ago Sunday on the first of the three messages now, Jesus Christ, Supernatural, Supernatural in the King's House, you'll recall that I suggested a discussion of the resurrection presupposed certain other facts. The first of those other facts is to assume Jesus lived. If you don't believe he lived, it's sort of a fruitless, abstract exercise in futility to debate whether he was crucified in the manner that I also ask us to assume and rose again. You're going to get a feel for why I said it's probably easier to prove that he lived, though most that talk about Christ go to the Gospels. But you don't have to. The trouble proved so intractable that the Emperor Claudius, same one to whom Caradoc would come, the Silurian king, and make his speech before the Roman Senate and move the Senate not to kill him, and Claudius to give him a house arrest, parole, and adopt his daughter and change her name to Claudia, and she'd marry the Roman senator to whom Paul would speak in his epistle in Romans and 2 Timothy as though they had the same mother. That's another story, as you well know. The Emperor Claudius, but I'm trying to set the Roman church in this time frame. The Emperor Claudius took the drastic step of banishing all Jews from the city. Among the ancient writers who mention this incident is Luke, who tells us in Acts 18:2 that when Paul arrived in Corinth, about A.D. 50, a year later, he found there, quote from Luke, a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. Now, the New Testament's okay to verify the riots and the banishment of Claudius. It just can't be used to verify Christ. One writer adds an interesting piece of information. This is the Roman author Suetonius, who about A.D. 120, approaching Marcion's day, compiled biographies of the first 12 Roman emperors from Julius Caesar onward. In his life of Claudius, he says of that emperor, this is the Roman author now, a classic historian who wrote biographies of the 12 first emperors, beginning with Julius Caesar. In his life of Claudius, he says of that emperor, quote, he expelled the Jews from Rome on account of the riots in which they were constantly indulging at the instigation of Crestus. Crestus, a common slave name, was a popular misspelling of the name of Christ. And deliberately they would apply it to slaves to degenerate this Christian claim, as they called the Christians in Jerusalem, Ebionites, the poor. The situation referred to was probably the result of the recent introduction of Christianity into the Jewish community of Rome with the controversy and quarreling to which it gave rise. Police action was called for, and when several decades later a historian had occasion to mention the incident, the police records provided one of his sources of information. Only the historian appears to have misunderstood the reference to one Crestus in the police records. Have you ever read any police records? He took the reference to mean that this Crestus was actually in Rome as ringleader of the riotous behavior in A.D. 49, but it was in another way that Crestus became the occasion of these disorders. Well, we've joined some new people, and I'm teaching on church history, combination of things. Right now, I took a pause from F.F. Bruce's study of the references to Christ outside of the Bible. But I think this might interest you, because I'm going to ask the people to make a call that are joining us at this half hour. It's next to the last day of this month. And you that I teach know what you're supposed to do. But though this might interest you. The purpose of the present division into chapters and verses in the Bible. Of course, King James good enough for Paul should be good enough for you. And I complain many times about chapter breaks at the wrong time. There shouldn't be a chapter break between Isaiah 43 and 44. Shouldn't be a chapter break at the end of the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians and the opening of the 16th, which suggests that taking up the collection was somehow separated from the resurrection. God didn't do it that way. The purpose of the present division into chapters and verses was to facilitate reference, and that's all. And none to do with the arrangement and the thought process of the original writers. In fact, the earliest canons of Scripture, the Uncial manuscripts, the earliest manuscripts, go ahead and sit down for just... No, stay there. I ain't going to be that long. Or capital letters without even spaces between the letters. You had to figure out where one word ended and another one started. No punctuation. Chapters and verses was to facilitate reference. These divisions sometimes, but not generally, ignore logical and natural divisions in the thought processes of the writer. Common opinion concerning chapter divisions attributes them to Cardinal Hugo of St. Cher for use in his concordance to the Latin Vulgate, first printed with modification at Bologna, 1479, just before Columbus sailed. Well, now the question is, does the inerrant Word of God include what this bird did in 1479? I'm reading from F.F. Bruce, Jesus and Christian Origins Outside the New Testament. Heathen, in other words. Suetonius makes a reference to the work of Claudius when the riot struck Rome among a large Jewish community in Rome in A.D. 49. That he expelled the Jews from Rome on account of the riots in which they were constantly indulging at the instigation of Crestus. And everywhere Paul went, preaching Christ, there was a riot among the Jewish Christians. Not Jewish Christians, among the Jews. So he confused the slave named Crestus with Christ, and the Christians coming to Rome, no doubt, caused the riots as they did everywhere they went. The expulsion of the Jewish community from Rome caused it, because remember, those early Christians, about 49 A.D., would go first, because they were Judaizing Christians, unless they'd heard the message of Paul. And the first place they'd go to worship would be the synagogue, and they'd go preaching their doctrine of Christ, and a riot would occur. So Claudius kicked them all out. Expulsion of the Jewish community from Rome caused a setback to the progress of Christianity in that city. For in A.D. 49, it appears to have been only as a distinctive movement with Judaism that Christianity was known there. But with the death of Claudius in A.D. 54, the expulsion edict became a dead letter. And that statement, by the way, is wrong because of the traditional viewpoint that fails to recognize the household of influence, which was Caradoc's household, the Silurian king, his daughter, a Christian, adopted by Claudius and married to a Roman senator. Rome was soon, in A.D. 54, when the edict of expulsion became a dead letter, soon full of Jews again, the Christian cause reestablished more securely than before. 10 years later, Christianity figured again in the police news of the capital. This time in a more macabre fashion, or macabre fashion than in the previous occasion. In A.D. 64, a disastrous fire swept the city. Almost before the flames were beaten out, a rumor began to circulate that the fire was no accident, that it had been started and fostered by command of the Emperor Nero, stepson and successor to Claudius. Perhaps the rumor was ill-founded, probably not, but Nero judged that the best way to get rid of the odium that it bade fair to bring upon him was to divert the blame to someone else. There are Neros in the Christian church today, friends. So he arranged that the Christians of Rome should be charged with fire raising. Dedicated himself, I'm sure, to destroying all matches. Or accounting for all matches. And many of them, in consequence, were burned on stakes or exposed to wild beasts. They were so unpopular, the Christians, as a result of this false charge that they started the fire in Rome, that he thought they could be attacked now with immunity anywhere, anytime. Suetonius, again, brings in the record, who wrote the lives of the first 12 histories, a Roman historian. Suetonius devotes a brief mention to this attack on the Christians of Rome in his life of Nero, as he did to the expulsions of the Jews in his life of Claudius. Quote, "Punishment was inflicted on the Christians, a body of people addicted to a novel and mischievous superstition." End of quote. But a fuller account of the matter is given by a contemporary of Suetonius, the Roman historian Tacitus. In the course of his Roman annals, written between A.D. 115 and 117, Tacitus mentions the fire of Rome and Nero's attempt to fasten the blame on the Christians. Quote, "a class of men loathed for their vices," he calls them. This is the first time that he has occasion to mention them, so he gives a brief account of their origin. This is Tacitus, the heathen, Latin historian. Quote, "They got their name from Christ, who was executed by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. That checked the pernicious superstition for a short time, but it broke out afresh, not only in Judea, where the plague first arose, but in Rome itself, where all the horrible and shameful things in the world collect and find a home." They even had a Washington, D.C. I'm telling you, there ain't nothing new. When police news becomes sufficiently significant, it provides the material for history, and this is illustrated in the passage from Tacitus. Not only was the action of the imperial police against the Christians of Rome worth recording, the more so in view of the dimensions to which Christianity had grown with the reign of Trajan, in which Tacitus was writing, but the police action, which had been carried out over 30 years previously, when Pilate was governor of Judea, acquired a significance that no Roman in A.D. 30 could have foreseen. They were just crucifying Jesus along with two other thieves. Pilate's execution of Christ, and any report that he may have sent to Rome about it, would never have been heard of again. If, in fact, that execution had put an end to the movement which Christ began. How many other people were crucified in Jerusalem? There's no record of, never will hear. If Christ's movement had ended, you wouldn't have heard about it. But when that movement, far from being crushed, advanced to Rome and attracted imperial attention there, there was some reason for investigating its origins. This Tacitus appears to have done. From the contemptuous and hostile tone which he adopts toward the Christians, we may gather that he did not seek his information from them. Where did he get it then? If he didn't seek it from them, where did he go for it? Most likely to some official record, possibly to Pilate's report, which, as we've seen, Justin and others had written saying, it's there for you to see. Who knows? Tacitus had an official standing which would give him access to such archives if indeed they survived to his day. Pilate is not mentioned in any other pagan document which has come down to us. The character of the man and his governorship is tellingly described by the Jewish writers Philo and Josephus. And it may be regarded as an instance of the irony of history that the only surviving reference to him in a pagan writer's works mentions him because of the sentence of death which he passed upon Christ. For a moment, Tacitus joins hands with the ancient Christian creed, which is recorded in the Scriptures, suffered under Pontius Pilate. So, the answer to the question is, there are records, but we've only begun. Pliny. Not plenty, Pliny. Not southern Pliny. Pliny the Younger. Not only may police news provide the material for history, when it becomes sufficiently significant, it may also provide, in however incidental a fashion, the material for literature. Tacitus and Suetonius had a contemporary called Pliny who had established himself, or has established for himself, a niche in posterity's memory. Now, with the changing meaning of English words, that puts Pliny in the proper position of history's memory. I know you've been at it a long time today, but you think on that a while. Tacitus and Suetonius had a contemporary called Pliny who has established for himself a niche in posterity's memory. I could tell you some people right now that don't care at all about Christ. They just want a niche in posterity's memory. More adequately said, memory's posterity. By the way in which he acquitted himself as a man of letters. We may indeed call him a man of letters in two senses. First, in the general sense of his being a literary figure. Second, in the sense that the particular kind of literature in which he distinguished himself was letter writing. Pliny is one of the world's great letter writers. We'll see his head on a stamp one day. Whose letters, unlike the ephemeral notes which most of us write, intended only for the perusal of the recipient, were written with one eye on a wider public and have attained the status of literary classics. Those that are ensuring themselves a place, a niche, in memory's posterity in the current evangelism brouhaha, have not even one eye on saving the church. Pliny is usually called Pliny the Younger, to distinguish him from his uncle Pliny the Elder. That makes sense. Whose great work on natural history is also a literary classic. The elder Pliny lost his life in the eruption of Vesuvius in A.D. 79 because of his insatiable curiosity about the workings of nature brought him too close to the center of volcanic activity. I know some TV evangelists that have an insatiable curiosity about the look of their face on TV. And they're bringing an eruption on. In all, 10 books of the younger Pliny's correspondence have come down to us. Of these, the 10th has a special interest for us, because it contains his correspondence, turn me up just a little, with the Emperor Trajan, who ruled A.D. 98 to 117, about A.D. 111, Pliny was appointed imperial legate of the Roman province of Bithynia in northwest Asia Minor. During his period of office there, he conducted an assiduous correspondence with the emperor, consulting him on every point which called for a decision. Pliny shows himself, in fact, as the complete civil servant of caricature, incapable of taking any decision on his own initiative. Pliny's letters to the emperor are rather wordy. He could have been a TV evangelist. The emperor's replies are terse and to the point. I wonder if he ever wrote any letters 2 weeks before he did what he said he was doing. When, for example, there were one or two serious outbreaks of fire in the chief cities of the province, one might have expected the governor to take the appropriate steps in this matter, at least on his own responsibility, just a fire crew. But no. Before organizing a fire brigade, he must consult the emperor. And on this occasion, the emperor's reply may surprise us. Quote, "Fire brigades should not be organized. The proper course is for each property owner and householder to have firefighting equipment constantly available, so that fires can be tackled before they spread too far. The trouble with fire brigades is simply this. Any organization which brings men together, whatever its original and ostensible purpose may be sooner or later, develops into a secret society with subversive political aims." Yeah, they're still worrying about that. That's why the world doesn't want the church. That's why the church got in trouble. We may be surprised at the emperor's decision, but it was based on the experience of several generations of Roman political life. It may help to explain in part the objection raised by enlightened administrators to meetings of Christians, whose claim to be a religious community was not admitted by imperial law. How, in fact, enlightened administrators at this time viewed Christianity may be seen by another exchange of letters between Pliny and the emperor. Pliny, who had never had any official contact with Christians during the 50 years of his life thus far, found himself obliged to deal with them in Bithynia because of the rapidity with which they were spreading in the province. Inevitably, he consulted the emperor. And just because Pliny's letter had the salt of literary immortality about him, what would normally have been a routine matter of administrative correspondence has been preserved to our day, and from it we derive information about a police action of which we should otherwise have known nothing. Here, then, is Pliny's letter to Trajan on the subject. "My lord, it is my custom to consult you whenever I'm in doubt about any matter. Who is better able to direct my hesitation or instruct my ignorance? I have never been present at Christian trials. Consequently, I do not know the precedents regarding the question of punishment or the nature of the Inquisition. I've been in no little doubt about whether some discrimination is made with regard to age, or whether the young are treated no differently from the older, whether renunciation wins indulgence, or it is of no avail to have abandoned Christianity if one has once been a Christian, whether the very profession of the name is to be punished, or only the disgraceful practices which go along with the name. So far, this has been my procedure." I want you to understand, Christians have been under attack for years. I'm still making a few points. "So far, this has been my procedure when people were charged before me with being Christians. So far. I have asked the accused themselves if they were Christians. If they said yes, I ask them a second and a third time, warning them of the penalty. If they persisted in saying yes, I ordered them to be led off to execution. For I had no doubt that whatever kind of thing it was they pleaded guilty to, their stubbornness and unyielding obstinacy at any rate deserved to be punished. He's a frustrated journalist. "There were others afflicted with the like madness whom I marked down to be referred to Rome because they were Roman citizens. Later, as usually happens, the trouble spread by the very fact that it was being dealt with." Do you notice any similarities? "The trouble spread by the very fact that it was being dealt with, and further varieties came to my notice. An anonymous document was laid before me by a prostitute who said she had serviced Jim Baker 5 times. That my glasses slipped. I'm still quoting Pliny, but I sort of got Pliny in there that wasn't there. Let's go back to the literal. An anonymous document was laid before me containing many people. Wait a minute. You want me to continue? Well, get on telephone.